I hope that our state looks at it very carefully and requests a waiver.
The Obama administration offers waivers for the No Child Left Behind Act. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Friday, September 23rd. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, Congress targets the post office program that Alaskans use to get goods to rural parts of the state.
If the bypass mail system wasn't subsidized, it would be outrageously expensive.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by
Northern Air Cargo. For over 54 years, Alaskans have entrusted Northern Air Cargo to transport their freight. Thank you, Alaska, for the opportunity to serve you for decades to come.
And by Arctic Wire Rope and Supply, stocking rope, chain, and boat anchors from 5 to 3,000 pounds on the web at arcticwirerope.com.
The U.S. Congress couldn't agree on a short-term spending plan to keep the government open after the end of this month, so the threat of a shutdown looms again. The lack of a plan's passage also threatens emergency aid to victims of natural disasters. APRN's Libby Casey reports.
The House went home for a week-long recess Friday after passing a Republican-led bill, but that same legislation could not pass the Democratic-controlled Senate, meaning there's no funding agreement to keep the government running past next Friday. Also in limbo is FEMA's Disaster Relief Fund that helps victims of natural disasters, like this year's hurricanes, floods, and fires. The federal agency says the fund will go broke by early next week. Both political parties are pointing the finger. Republicans want to pay for the boost in disaster relief funding by cutting a green car technology program. But Democrats say that Energy Department money creates jobs. Alaska's delegation voted with their parties. What makes this a cliffhanger is that both bodies are supposed to be on recess next week. The Senate is now stuck in D.C. with another vote Democrats are likely to support planned for Monday. Senator Mark Begich's press secretary, Julie Haskett, says it's partisan politics at its worst.
It's very frustrating that they can't seem to just get their work done. He had a full schedule this weekend and Monday and pretty much all next week in Alaska, some of that of which is now upended by the fact that the Senate will be in session on Monday. So we just carry on and keep our fingers crossed that they can get through the partisan bickering and actually get something done back there so the senator can get home.
Senator Begich and Congressman Don Young are supposed to be in Alaska with Transportation Secretary Ray LaHood starting Tuesday. It now looks like Begich will join them partway through the visit. Senator Lisa Murkowski plans to skip Monday's Senate vote since she'd be a no anyway, which is expected to lose. And she has longstanding plans to be in the village of Buckland to celebrate the groundbreaking of its first village-wide sewer system. But at this point, even if the Senate passes a Democratic-favored bill as expected on Monday, how it will be reconciled with the House is up in the air. And the countdown is on for victims of disasters and for funding the government after next week. In Washington, I'm Libby Casey.
States can now get waivers from the requirements of the No Child Left Behind, the Bush-era education law. In exchange, they'll have to come up with ways on the state level to boost student achievement and close gaps in performance. Alaska and other states have long criticized the law, saying it overtests students and doesn't account for the uniqueness of places like rural Alaska. APRN's Annie Feit reports.
The White House has been pushing Congress to update the nation's education law and throw out some of No Child Left Behind's requirements, but legislation has not yet moved forward. So President Obama announced the change in the White House East Room, surrounded by educators and students.
So starting today, we'll be giving states more flexibility to meet high standards. Keep in mind, the change we're making is not lowering standards. We're saying we're going to give you more flexibility to meet high standards. We're going to let states, schools, and teachers come up with innovative ways to give our children the skills they need to compete for the jobs of the future.
The White House says under the waiver program, states, districts, and schools will have more flexibility to use federal funds in ways deemed most important at the local level, and rural districts will have additional flexibility. The new plan minimizes the power of No Child Left Behind to label a school as failing, and states will have more power to figure out how to improve low-performing schools. The initial response from the state was cautious. The Education Commissioner's Special Assistant Marcy Herman says it will be a few weeks before her department finishes analyzing the White House plan. And Herman says the Education Department doesn't yet know whether it will apply for the waiver.
I think that people are viewing it as a positive thing, but there very well could be strings attached that the governor would not want to accept as part of this process.
Governor Sean Parnell has a history of rebuffing education proposals by the Obama administration. Alaska was one of only two states that didn't apply for millions of dollars through the Race to the Top program in its first round. That's a national competition aimed at fostering state-based school reform. The governor said it had too many strings attached. The superintendent of the Anchorage School District is hoping Parnell sees this program differently. Carol Como calls the No Child Left Behind law one-size-fits-all legislation and says it hasn't worked well for urban or rural districts in Alaska.
We all approve of the intent of the legislation in closing the achievement gap, but it's the rigidity of the sanctions rather than really expecting states to reach high standards and helping schools do consistently increasing achievement, but without these artificial bars that forces, frankly, many schools to just narrow the curriculum and teach to the test.
To get the waiver, states have to meet some requirements. Among other things, they must come up with a system to reward improving schools and high-achieving ones serving low-income students, and have a plan to intervene in the lowest-performing schools. With help from Libby Casey in Washington, D.C., I'm Annie Feit in Anchorage.
Alaska's bypass mail subsidy is being targeted by a California lawmaker looking to trim costs and generate more revenue for the financially ailing U.S. Postal Service. Republican Congressman Daryl Issa, the chairman of the House Committee on Oversight and Government Reform, is a primary sponsor of legislation called the Postal Reform Act of 2011. Within the legislation, Section 408 would require the state of Alaska to reimburse the Postal Service for the cost of bypass mail. Congressman Issa was not available for comment today, but Alaska District Postal Service spokesman Ernie Swanson says the subsidy costs USPS at least $70 million per year.
That's the amount that we lose, basically, on it. It undoubtedly costs us more than that. I know the representative was citing a number of about $100 million, and that may be close to the total cost that it is to the Postal Service.
Bypass mail is unique to Alaska and was put into place years ago through the efforts of late Senator Ted Stevens. The Postal Service contracts with private carriers to fly mail to off-road communities. Without it, the price of everyday items would be cost prohibitive.
Bread, milk, food, that sort of thing. It's already expensive, of course, but if the bypass mail system wasn't subsidized, it would be outrageously expensive. And I can't tell you if it would be 20, 30, 40, 50% more, but it would be significantly more than even the high price that they pay now.
Swanson says USPS takes no position on legislation designed to help them stop hemorrhaging billions of dollars. But he says recent measures the agency has taken to trim costs has gotten the attention of Congress, and ISA's bill is one of several pieces of legislation being proposed to aid that effort. Swanson says USPS lost $8.5 billion last year, and at the close of the fiscal year next week, he says they're projecting $9 to $10 billion in losses for 2011.
The amount of revenue we might possibly receive from the state of Alaska if this legislation were ever passed would just be a small, small portion of the losses that we're experiencing.
Senator Lisa Murkowski sent a flurry of letters against the measure yesterday. One asked senators on the Homeland Security and Government Oversight Committee to oppose the legislation. Another went to the Postmaster General, Patrick Donahoe, asking him to affirm that he will preserve the bypass mail program. And Murkowski sent a third letter to Senator Daniel Akaka, requesting a hearing of the Senate Indian Affairs Committee, saying that remote Native communities where often no internet is available would be harmed by the effort. Murkowski wrote that Congress must not abandon the principle of universal service at universal rates. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, a visit to Whittier's best-kept secret.
Now Whittier has knowledge of its heritage, and it's something that I think the people that live there take pride in.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by BP, supporting public broadcasting in Alaska.
City and state crews have been busy in Petersburg today, cleaning up damage caused by heavy rains and winds. This morning, a large landslide blocked Mitkoff Highway in Petersburg. The storm also caused an extensive power outage and downed multiple trees and electrical lines. The Alaska Airlines cargo terminal lost a substantial part of its metal roof to the wind, and several vehicles around town were damaged by falling trees. KFSK's Matt Lichtenstein reports.
State Department of Transportation workers used backhoes and other heavy equipment to clear the landslide between 6 and 7 Mile Mitkoff Highway throughout the day. DOT Highway Foreman Ted Sokol directed the effort to clear the huge pile of mud, rocks, and trees that blocked both lanes for several hours.
Pretty much covers the whole road all the way across, about 12 feet high, probably 150, 200 feet wide. There's trees in there at least 4 feet through, so we got a our loader's here, and we rented an excavator from Rock and Road. We're going to get this cleaned up, hopefully, in the next 4 or 5 hours.
There was still a lot of muddy water running off the steep mountainside above the highway as the crew worked, and there were two blocked culverts that caused the drainage ditches on the side of the road to back up with water. The slide was one of several problems the crew had to deal with. The DOT's Mike Etcher said there were a number of downed trees further out the highway.
We drove out the road for inspection, and we started cutting trees.
About Omer
Creek, because the wind was really hitting well there, and we got out to Black Reef, cut two more, and we came back, and more on 19 Mile, right down at the fur farm, everything, just there's whole patches, there's more that are going to come down. So.
Meanwhile, the line carrying power to Petersburg from the Tyee Lake Hydroelectric Plant also went out shortly before 8 in the morning, causing an island-wide power outage. Even before that, falling trees cut the power to the Frederick Point neighborhood. The city made several repairs to the lines and turned on the backup diesel plant, restoring power to most of the town within a few hours. However, a downed power pole near the Petersburg Bible Church on Sandy Beach Road left part of that neighborhood without power for longer. Crews also worked into the afternoon to reestablish power for residents out the road. There were no injuries reported, but at least a few parked vehicles were hit by falling trees or debris around town. Over at the airport, high winds ripped a substantial part of the metal roofing from the Alaska Airlines cargo terminal. Alaska Airlines employee Gail Andrew was in the passenger area next door.
And I was in the lobby, and I heard this big ripping, roaring sound, and looked out and saw the roof flying across the road onto another car.
Everybody's safe, though, it sounds like.
Yes.
All right,
just a little wet back there. It's really wet.
City and state officials urged the public to stay indoors and avoid driving while the storm continued. Numerous businesses and agencies closed for the day due to the storm and power outages. Petersburg City Manager Carl Hagerman was busy checking on the various problem spots around town. As we spoke, he received several updates by cell phone, including a call about his own home.
That was a call. There is a tree leaning against my house, evidently. But a small one, so not to worry.
Beyond the power line issue, downed trees, and Alaska Airlines, Hagerman did not see a large amount of damage to the city.
I think the power lines and some trees down have been the biggest issues that we're seeing. There's a lot of water moving around, so we're trying to monitor ditch lines and culverts to make sure we don't get any backups there and have any roads wash out because of overflowing ditches. But I think predominantly it's the wind damage that we saw earlier with trees coming down on power lines and the airport damage.
According to National Weather Service data, Petersburg saw peak winds of at least 40 miles per hour between 7:30 and 8 in the morning, though other observers in town reported gusts up to 70 miles per hour. Wind gusts in Wrangell topped out at just over 50 miles an hour around the same time. The Weather Service reports the highest wind gusts in the area, just over 111 miles an hour, happened at 4 in the morning at Lincoln Rock near Prince of Wales Island. Winds diminished in the afternoon. In Petersburg, I'm Matt Lichtenstein.
A new report says rural Alaska Native children have more than four times the dental decay of others living in the U.S. The Centers for Disease Control and the Alaska Department of Health and Social Services conducted the study. It looks specifically at water fluoridation and diet. KDLG's Dasha Eaton has more.
The report is based on a 2008 investigation into dental decay in rural Alaska. Brad Whistler is the dental officer with the Alaska Department of Health and Social Services and was one of the investigators for the study. He says the study found that lack of water fluoridation and too much soda pop consumption were two key factors associated with dental decay severity in both baby and adult teeth.
This report found that rural Alaska Native children experience about 4.5 times the level of severe dental decay as the general population of the United States. When they compared children living in fluoridated versus non-fluoridated villages, they found less severe dental decay in children living in fluoridated villages. And then the final point that's touched on in the report, they found increased dental decay as Alaska Native children consume more soda pop.
The CDC investigation was requested by the department on behalf of the region due to the extent and severity of the dental decay in Native children. The investigation consisted of screening 348 children ages 4 through 15 for dental decay. Parents were also surveyed on factors suspected to influence decay. According to the report, approximately 400 children under 6 years of age in the study region had extraction and/or restoration of multiple teeth with cavities. Whistler says the study had two conclusions.
The real work that the Native corporations are working on is to reduce the level of disease in the population. This highlights that water fluoridation is one of the ways they might do that in villages that have the capacity to implement fluoridation. And the second part is it also highlights the role of diet in terms of watching the amount of sugar and sweetened beverages that young children are consuming.
Numerous national and international studies have documented the role of water fluoridation in reducing dental decay. However, this is the first such study in Alaska. Dental decay studies say water fluoridation can reduce dental decay by about 27%. In Dillingham, I'm Daisha Eaton.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by the Doyon family of companies working together to build Alaska's future. Support for AK comes from the Federal Aviation Administration, providing information on passengers' rights and responsibilities. FAA.gov/go/FlyAlaska or toll free at 1-866-357-4704.
Ketchikan,
Kotzebue,
Dillingham,
Sitka,
Chugiak,
Fairbanks,
Fort Yukon,
Wrangell,
Barrow,
Unalaska, Dutch Harbor,
Alaknarechamute.
This is AK on Alaska News Nightly. I'm Jennifer Canfield. This week on AK, hidden gems. Secluded Whittier on the western shore of Prince William Sound is best known as a recreational center. Its small, crowded boat harbor is the starting point for fishing and kayaking adventures, and some visitors get their first glimpse of Alaska cruising through glacier-laced fjords to Whittier's docks. But the community is hiding something, and those in the know, like KSKA's Ellen Lockyer, are letting the secret out.
It's a blustery fall day. Edit that, it's a raining sideways wind howling day in Portage as I approach the Anton Anderson Tunnel and prepare to drive 2 miles or so of road hewn through solid rock to Whittier. Like many before me, I wonder while driving just who was Anton Anderson.
He was from New Zealand, by the way, and he was quite the guy. He was almost a self-educated engineer, very intelligent, very hardy, physical man. And tough. He came to Alaska in 1916 with the Alaska Engineering Commission to survey the route for the railroad. He learned how to engineer these tunnels by working on the Great Northern Railroad tunnel through the Cascade Mountains.
Ted Spencer knows. Spencer lives in San Diego now, but he's a museum exhibits designer by trade, and he helped develop the Prince William Sound Museum, Whittier's best kept secret. That's where I'm heading. It's just up Whittier Street, where despite the slanting rain, you can see the red awning over the front of Joe and Annie Shin's grocery store. The museum is inside the store, no, not next to the groceries, but off in a room of its own. Inside, colorful, professionally built exhibits are in step with museum standards of lighting and temperature. They're full of rare photos that offer a glimpse into a history that some Alaskans have forgotten. Fred Margraf dropped into the museum from Fairbanks for his first look.
I've never been to Whittier, so far it's nice, yeah. Very interesting, yeah.
The museum has got a lot more on this Anderson fellow, who Spencer credits with founding the community. Spencer tracked down Anderson's last surviving daughter, who had her father's diaries.
That is like hitting the mother lode. So for a period of time, I had 1941 and 1942 years of Anton Anderson's original diaries in my hands. He didn't just honcho the building of the tunnel. He led the first team of people in there in a small boat and landed on the beach and started cutting brush for tents and stuff, and talks about his day-to-day tribulations, the wind, the rain, the mosquitoes, plane crashes, boat sinking.
Ted Spencer has developed several other museums in the state, but this one is close to his heart. It opened in 2005 after years of work.
The history of Whittier has been lost. If a community doesn't have a sense of their heritage, they kind of lose their identity. When that happens, there's kind of a diffusion of community spirit. Now Whittier has knowledge of its heritage, and it's something that I think the people that live there take pride in.
City employee Diana Barnes is part of that community pride. She says early pioneers had a tough time.
It was pretty well hidden. They couldn't hardly find the town with all the overcast and stuff.
Before the tunnel was built, Whittierites hiked over Portage Pass to get a lift on the railroad. Now visitors come to the museum from all over the globe, says museum board member Sue Cogswell.
Customers are asked to pay $3 a person, and we've had people from every country imaginable.
At $3, still a bargain, say Alaskans Margraf and Larry Little in from Soldotna.
Well, yeah, the photographs are amazing, all these old photographs.
A lot of things I didn't realize, like I didn't realize Jimmy Doolittle was out of Nome.
Much of the museum's space is devoted to the state's role in World War II, with a special emphasis on Alaska's legends of flight, like Jimmy Doolittle and, of course, Ted Stevens. Whittier was built by the military for military needs, so it's fitting to end our tour with the story of General Simon Bolivar Buckner, who directed the scramble to prepare Alaska when the United States entered the conflict.
He was the guy that was in command of the military forces in Alaska just prior to the war, and he understood the coming war on the horizon, and he worked like crazy to get Alaska prepared for war, the creation of airfields and other military facilities, and Alaska was fortunate to get a man of his caliber.
Buckner died on Okinawa, the highest-ranking officer to be killed in the Pacific Theater. Today, an abandoned building in Whittier bears Buckner's name. Once it housed 1,000 troops under one roof, while today the little museum that keeps the past in perspective is bursting at the seams.
We're running out of room. We're starting to overflow into the hallways.
Spencer says the next phase is to get the museum into its own building. For AK, I'm Ellen Lockyer.
Now it's time for our weekly trip around the state for 300 villages. This week we're heading up to the tallest mountain in North America, or more specifically, the national park that surrounds it. A few hardy souls live in Denali National Park year-round. We caught up with one of them.
My name is Richard Moore, and I'm a United States Park Ranger here at Denali National Park and Preserve. Well, myself and most of the rangers who I work with live in the park in government housing. And most of us live in small two-bedroom houses provided by the government or two-bedroom apartments, and we pay rent through our paychecks to the National Park Service. At headquarters, so it's about 3 miles into the park on the park road. It's a very small community of about 15 residences. Well, we keep the road plowed to our residences. We're lucky, unless we have a snow event or something, we can usually get around by car. Many people in the area do use snowmobiles to recreate, or many of our park employees own dogs and do quite a bit of mushing in the area. In the summer here, it can be fairly busy. We have all the visitors driving the park road, and we have a lot of bus traffic, but in the winter, we don't have any of that. away from the highway, and so it's quite often you can walk out your front door and not hear anything at all except perhaps the dogs in the dog yard barking. It's interesting because it can be social, especially in the winter. We're a little community, so we have game night on Friday nights. We have quite a few potluck dinners or birthday parties and that sort of thing. But at the same time, we also have friends in the local community of Healy or McKinley Village as well who we socialize with. In the summer, it seems like everybody's working all the time. Winter's our time to be social and reconnect with friends and do things in the evening. I think what we appreciate right now is talking about our son, so our one-year-old Finn. And we have to be careful this month to put him down in the yard, because if we turn around and then turn back, he'll have blueberries in each hand and be stuffing them hand over fist in his mouth, along with leaves and any other parts of the blueberry bush he could get in his hands. Summer is such a busy time, and you work such long hours that you don't even remember the summer times. The winter time is a time to relax and regroup and center yourself and enjoy the place in which you live and work. And if I leave Denali and move somewhere else, especially to the lower 48, I don't think I'll ever forget the feelings I get in the winter of being outside in the cold and quiet, watching the northern lights or sunset in the middle of the afternoon.
That was Richard Moore, a park ranger at Denali National Park. 300 Villages is AK's attempt to put every community in Alaska on the radio. Thanks for listening to AK. We had help this week from Ellen Lockyer in Whittier and Pat Yak in Denali National Park. Tune in next week for more unique stories from around the state. I'm Jennifer Canfield.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. You can follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Matt Lichtenstein in Petersburg and Dacia Eaton in Dillingham. Jennifer Canfield was our AK guest host this week. APRN's Libby Casey reported from Washington, D.C. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. And I'm Lori Townsend. Have a great weekend.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
the Pebble Partnership, developing a comprehensive mine plan that meets Alaska's regulatory requirements while supporting sustainable fisheries in Southwest Alaska. PebblePartnership.com.
And by
Solstice Advertising, bringing creativity to Alaska businesses and nonprofits, from research and strategy to print, web, and broadcast production. Solstice Advertising, an agency for brands that want to shine. The Federal Aviation Administration sets standards for the operation of aircraft in airports and provides services to the flying public. Passengers are influential in making flying safer in Alaska, so when passengers know their rights and responsibilities, aviation is safer for everyone. There's more information online at faa.gov/go/flyalaska or toll-free at 1-866-357-4704. This message sponsored by the FAA.
Whether visiting Barrow or attending business in Juneau, APRN goes with listeners wherever they roam. Your company's message can span across Alaska on 26 stations. Find out how by calling 907-550-8437.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.